Von Forrest was so low on the Washington totem pole that he hadn't even been able to get anyone at the Pentagon to listen to him, much less think about how to get Congress to fund a program to design and produce lightweight, exotic killing devices. Under the best of circumstances, with a conventional weapons plan that no one opposes, moving a program through Congress would take at least a year, but not for Charlie Wilson. Once he turned to his fellow appropriators to shortcut the system and turned Forrest's vision into a reality. Within a few weeks of hearing Forrest's implausible proposition, Charlie emerged from a House-Senate Appropriations Conference with a commitment to fund the most unconventional weapons program of the decade. Its official name was the Weapons Upgrade Program, but it might just as well have been called Charlie Wilson's Personal Afghan War Chest. One of the more unusual features of the program was a clause that exempted it from having to follow the rules and regulations that guide all of the Pentagon's other weapons procurement and development programs. It was such a radical departure that Wilson knew it would have no chance of ultimately being implemented unless it first won the endorsement of the Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger. Thanks to Joanne and her carefully orchestrated dinner parties, Charlie had come to know Weinberger socially. Beyond that, for almost 4 years, in spite of being a liberal Democrat, he had been a critical ally on the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, voting for each and every item in Reagan's massive arms buildup. At one hearing, he'd even told Weinberger, "Mr. Secretary, there are a lot of things I don't understand and some with which I don't agree, but because you say they are important, I am going to vote for all of them." As Charlie saw it, the bottom line was that he had done a lot for Weinberger, and it was time to cash in his chips. At breakfast with the defense secretary, Wilson began by saying, "All I want is $10 million." But then came the catch. For starters, he wanted the Pentagon to give the program a complete waiver on all red tape. No specs, no feasibility studies, no minority contracts, not even competitive bidding. There wasn't time, he argued. The Mujahideen were fighting and dying for America. They were fighting America's war against America's principal enemy, and no one in the government was trying to create weapons and devices that could give these primitive freedom fighters a chance. Money was not the issue, said Wilson. This was war, and he wanted Weinberger to unleash the Pentagon's most devilish inventors and tinkerers to think big and small and to begin delivering the goods within weeks. He added one final request. He wanted to be granted some measure of personal control over the program. As Wilson recalls this moment, Weinberger initially expressed concern about the legality of such a program, but only for a moment. Yes, he said, Charlie could count on his support. The rest, getting the trusty staffers on the subcommittee to conceal the appropriation in a line item that no one would ever find, was hardly a challenge. Charlie Wilson was now presiding over another congressional first, his very own invisible $10 million a year exotic weapons program. There were days in his office when he felt as if he was playing the role of M in a James Bond novel, summoning the government's most ingenious inventors to decide what weapons and devices to commission for his freedom fighters. Wilson had originally intended to fund this program through the CIA so that Gust could run it, but Avrakatos wanted no part of it. It was a year and a half since Charlie had come up with the money to buy the Swiss Oerlikons, and not so much as one had been given to the Mujahideen. In frustration, Wilson had begun lobbying the agency to give the Israelis a contract for the Charlie Horse, the weapon Charlie had commissioned Zvi's engineers to design for the Mujahideen. But bringing the Israelis into the CIA's Muslim Jihad was not what Avrakatos considered a reasonable option. There were many reasons why he was adamantly opposed to dealing with Israel. To begin with, it would risk alienating the Saudis, who were putting up half the money for the program. Beyond that, why risk alienating the legions of Muslim hotheads around the world who would draw the most extreme conclusions if it became known that the CIA was sneaking Jewish weapons into the Jihad? Avrakatos had an even greater concern, which he wasn't at liberty to share with Wilson. It centered on his suspicions about the role Israel was playing with Oliver North and the White House in their ill-fated arms for hostages negotiations with Iran. From the time he'd first learned about North's operation, he had smelled a disaster in the making. The more he learned, the more he came to believe that the Israelis were walking a naive and inexperienced Oliver North, and with him, the United States, into a trap. Repeatedly, he would try to keep the agency from being sucked into what was to become known as the Iran-Contra scandal. As it turned out, he didn't have the power to do that, but he was determined not to permit the Israelis to become identified with any direct CIA commission connected to Afghanistan. So instead of the CIA taking on the weapons upgrade program, it went to the Pentagon. But in fact, Charlie Wilson himself ended up overseeing much of this eccentric program out of his own congressional office, and it turned out to be a wild and remarkable success story. "There were all these little scientists in the Pentagon, bureaucratic misfits who just needed to be freed," Wilson recalled years later. "We gave them a little money and made them immune to procurement laws. They're mad scientist types. They love to tinker with things that blow up but hate to fill out forms, hate to follow the chain of command, hate to wait." Typical of the characters who gravitated to this program were Chuck Barnard and his brother. They had grown up working in their father's auto garage, and as far as they were concerned, the Pentagon didn't just buy $600 toilet seats. It made $20 million tanks that couldn't survive in a face-off with one of their $1 million stripped-down Volkswagens armed with a range of their favorite high-tech weaponry. In their view, almost everything the Pentagon did to develop and buy weapons was wasteful, ineffective, and designed to fight some previous war. For the first time, thanks to Wilson, these tinkerers were free to innovate at will and more or less without restraint. Within weeks, they began developing an astonishing collection of weapons. The Spanish mortar, for example, was designed to make it possible for the Mujahideen to communicate directly with American navigation satellites to deliver repeated rounds within inches of their designated targets. Global positioning technology is well known today, but back in 1985 it struck Wilson as the most astonishing capability. Just the thought of Afghan tribesmen who had never seen a flush toilet signaling an American satellite to fire precision rounds at a Red Army stronghold was almost too much to believe. The weapon's name was purposefully misleading, chosen to conceal the fact that major portions of this Spanish mortar were being built by the Israelis. Milt Bearden, the station chief who would dominate the war's latter years, actually came to rely on the steady stream of crazy new weapons that kept coming online from this offbeat program. His strategy called for introducing a new weapon into the battle every 3 months or so in order to bluff the Red Army into thinking their enemy was better armed and supported than it was. The Spanish mortar, for example, with its satellite-guarded charge, was rarely deployed and may only have succeeded because the Pakistani ISI advisors were along to direct the fire, but the Soviets didn't know that. When the weapon was first used, it wiped out an entire Spetsnaz outpost with a volley of perfect strikes. And as soon as Bearden learned from the CIA's intercepts that the commander of the 40th Army had helicoptered to the scene, he knew that from that day on the Soviets would have to factor in the possibility that the Mujahideen had acquired some deadly targeting capability. For that reason alone, the weapon was a success, even if never fired again. Bearden became so intoxicated with this kind of psychological warfare that he later developed plans to have a group of Mujahideen shoot dead Russian soldiers with crossbows. To him, the vision of men who might kill you with a bow and arrow one day, or with a satellite-guided mortar the next, would be unnerving to any army. Neither Von Forrest nor Charlie Schnabel were officially part of the program, just as Wilson's name never appeared on any organizational chart. But both men became so intimately involved with the tinkerers and the decisions about which weapons to develop that they began to hold their own informal meetings, which Wilson often attended and which Schnabel nicknamed the Sewing Circle. Wilson reveled in the decidedly unbureaucratic spirit among these happy warriors as they talked about the next killing machine they planned to smuggle to the Mujahideen. "I'd like to see the look on Ivan's face when he gets this one up his ass," they would say, laughing. While Charlie and the tinkerers were starting to tap into the outer realms of 20th century technology, their freedom fighters were often stuck in another age. In a meeting with the elderly fundamentalist Mujahideen leader Yunis Khalis, Wilson managed to remain respectful when the Muslim commander said he had just seen a movie with soldiers wearing thick Spanish armor. The red-bearded Afghan explained that the Russians had placed millions of mines throughout his country and his men were taking fearful losses. Could the congressman arrange to send several thousand suits of armor so his men could navigate safely through the minefields? No, Wilson explained, because he had even better devices in the works. Sometimes Charlie could hardly believe what the tinkerers were coming up with for these medieval warriors. He could picture a bearded Mujahideen on a mountaintop looking like a child flying a large toy airplane. But the tinkerers had built this model airplane with a video camera mounted on its wing so that an Afghan could guide this flying bomb right through the window of a Soviet compound from 10 miles away. The concept was incredibly simple. It drew on the marvel of fiber optics, which allows signals to be passed in two directions simultaneously. In this case, it meant that an Afghan operating the drone could see the camera's images in a monitor and use a joystick to direct the explosive load wherever he might want to send it. In deference to Wilson's commanding influence, the tinkerers would call this weapon, powered by a chainsaw motor, the Texas Chainsaw.